The Beat podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only.
Hello, and welcome to part one of our mini podcast series on the topic of what are the options for uncontrolled seizures when drugs don't work. This series is brought to you by Nutritia Ketogenics, and I'm Sue Wood, specialist dietitian at Matthews Friends Clinics. Today, I'm joined by Professor Helen Cross, and we'll be discussing the history of anti-seizure medications, their potential side effects, and the risks of uncontrolled seizures. Welcome, Professor Cross.
Hello, good morning.
Professor Cross is the Prince of Wales Chair of Childhood Epilepsy and Head of the Developmental Neuroscience Programme at UCL Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health. She's also the Honorary Consultant in Paediatric Neurology, Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children's NHS Foundation Trust London and Young Epilepsy Lingfield UK. And also Treasurer of the International League Against Epilepsy 2017 to 2021, President-elect 2021-2025, and the Clinical Advisor to the National Children's Epilepsy Surgery Service and Clinical Advisor to the update of the NICE Guidelines for Childhood Epilepsy 2018 to 2021. And as Coordinator, has developed the European Reference Network for Rare and Complex Epilepsies, EpiCare, launched in 2017. Helen, every minute of your day must already be accounted for. So thank you so much for joining us today. So can I just start by asking you, when was the first anti-seizure medication invented?
I think it's fair to say that the first medication that was developed or specifically for epilepsy was phenobarbital, which came online in 1912. So we've had over 100 years of true anti-epileptic medications. That aside, bromide was used earlier than that in the 19th century, actually the mid-19th century, but hadn't really, it was used for a multitude of things and I think wasn't really classed as an anti-epileptic drug at the time. And then it was not until 1938 that phenytoin came on board.
Right, okay. And how are the anti-seizure medications thought to work?
Well, I think that's a million-dollar question, really. I don't, you know, we have to bear in mind that, yes, the anti-epileptic drugs are thought to target reducing excitability of neurons, maybe even enhancing inhibition of electrical currents through the neurons. And they may do that in a multitude of different ways. And I think it's also fair to say that although there are a few medications that were developed with this specifically in mind, many of them were actually found by accident, and only subsequently evaluated in vitro in the laboratory to determine how they may, in fact, exert preventative measures against seizures, namely enhancing inhibition or reducing excitation. So, they all have different ways of working. There are groups of anti-epileptic medications that may have the same mechanism of action or a similar mechanism of action. For example, those who change or block sodium channel currents, such as carbamazepine, phenytoin, lamotrigine, lacosamide even, they are of all of the same group of anti-epileptic drugs. But there are others who have more than one mechanism of action, and exactly what is their most significant mechanism of action is difficult to know.
Yes. So that would be how the group, they're grouped together. They're sort of the type of anti-seizure medication and how they act. So what are the main types of anti-seizure medications now available?
Well, there are different groups. And in fact, there are different groups acting on different, now we've got newer medications that have got actually different mechanisms of action. So we have the sodium channel blockers, which are actually affecting the way sodium channels are affecting currents from the neurons. And that's the likes of carbamazepine, phenytoin, lamotrigine, and even lacosamide. We have those that may affect GABA receptors, which are inhibitory receptors in such as vigabatrin. Sodium valproate has a degree. The benzodiazepines have a degree of effect on that. And you have others that have many different mechanisms of action, not least topiramate, which has got at least five different mechanisms of action. So which is the most relevant? Some would talk about it being a polypharmacy. And you've got others that act on very specific channels on the neuron that are newer medications such as perampanel.
Okay, okay. And so what are the main side effects of anti-seizure medications?
Well, of course, the problem we have is that when we're trying to change the function of the brain and prevent seizures, it's very difficult to have a selective effect on that function without affecting other things that may, such as sedation, such as slowed thinking, such as feeling tired, lethargic. You know, these are the main side effects that are actually complained about. Interestingly, of course, they don't occur in everybody. And in fact, you would say that only about 10% of those who take medication may experience a significant side effect. Although on direct questioning, you might get reports of in many more individuals that they feel that they're not completely right taking medication all the time.
Okay.
Other side effects may include...
Side effects really are not as common,
Yeah, and the other side effects also may include gastrointestinal side effects. So there's nausea, less of commonly diarrhea, but also less commonly vomiting. And again, these may be side effects that are experienced when you start taking a medication and they may actually wear off after a period of time.
Okay, all right, then that's really interesting. And we know that around 30% of patients' seizures are not effectively managed by current anti-seizure medications. So what are the risks to the patient if continuing to have uncontrolled seizures?
Well, of course, there are many different seizure types, but the most significant problem is they're unpredictable.
Yes.
And of course, that means and they may interrupt thoughts and interrupt awareness. And therefore, there's the dangers of the risk of injury from them happening unpredictably at all times and also interrupting day to day life, of course. There's also the risk, particularly with convulsive seizures, although it's difficult to say the only seizure type that probably has not got this risk is absent seizures.
Okay.
But the problem of sudden unexplained death in epilepsy, which, you know, we know that's related to ongoing convulsive seizures, particularly another risk factor is if they occur at night. And this is a real risk occurring in about 1 in 200 people per year. And although you could say it's rare, I say rare, in a sort of even the relative risk, it is a real risk. And therefore, you want to optimise quality of life and minimise that risk by controlling seizures if at all possible.
No, of course, it's so important to get those under control, isn't it? So just finally, where does the controversial cannabidiol or CBD fit into the picture?
Well, cannabidiol is as Epidiolex, which is a cannabinoid, but without any of the THC, the tetrahydrocannabinol.
Yes.
It's a medication that's been developed by GW Pharma and now licensed in two particular types of epilepsy, seizures in two particular types of epilepsy, Lennox-Gastaut syndrome and Dravet syndrome, two particularly complex early onset developmental and epileptic encephalopathies. And in the US, it's licensed to be used on its own if other medications fail. And in Europe, it can only be used in conjunction with clobazam. Now, it is another anti-epileptic drug. I don't think we've got any thought that it's doing anything specifically. It is different from a mechanistic point of view. But again, the belief now is it's not acting on the endocannabinoid system, but there are other changes at the neurotransmitter junction that are actually happening as a result of cannabidiol. But that said, it is another anti-epileptic drug, and whether it is going to have benefit in a wider range of epilepsies, there's no reason why not. But the problem is we only have randomized control trial data in Dravet syndrome and Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, and hence why the license has been granted for that, because that's where the data is.
No.
Looking more widely, there's a lot of discussion about cannabinoids about hemp oils, about CBD with the THC component, which is the component in that actually causes the high in cannabis. But the thing is, we have no data as to whether it's required. We have no data as to the safety. We haven't got data as to the wider remit of treating epilepsies with the cannabinoids. And that is what we need to seek out in the future.
Of course. Yeah, of course. So many thanks to Helen for joining me today. And we hope you have found our discussions of interest.
My pleasure. It's great to have joined you.
Join me for part two of our mini podcast series when Dr. Shakti Agrawal, consultant paediatric neurologist at Birmingham Women's and Children's Hospital, will be discussing the treatment gap for drug-resistant and complex epilepsy. Thank you again also to Nutritia Ketogenics for making this podcast series possible. May I wish you all the very best, and thank you for listening.